John Greenberg and Scott Harris from the Cubs front office, everybody.
That was fun.
I was pleased to fulfill my job as prop master here at Lincoln Hall. That was pretty exciting.
You were great.
Thanks, man. Thanks,
man. You were
man.
So good.
It's about me. Let's all remember that. Until right now, when our second panel hits the stage, this is the panel full of really smart guys. So maybe, Danny, you can help me out in talking to these human beings, all right?
I was going to leave.
Well, you know, somebody's got to stay. Jim Callis is here from MLB Pipeline and formerly Baseball America for decades and decades and decades. Pretty cool that Jim Callis, who's always been based in Chicago, the scouting guru, is going to join us up here. Jim, oh, look at that.
Oh, yeah, climb
impressive. Jim, nice to see you.
How's it going, Jim?
We also have Craig Edwards from Fangraphs is here. Craig Edwards, who was part of things last year and has written a lot of great stuff. He just wrote about the four starting pitchers, and not Eddie Butler or Brett Anderson, but just wrote about those guys. Craig is here somewhere. He will hop out and join us.
We also have Rob Arthur. He's a baseball columnist at 538. Mm-hmm. So lots of projections and advanced stats that I don't understand to get into with him.
And PitchFX versus StatCast and everything that's going on with that stuff with Rob Arthur. Hey, there's some people. How are you? And also, Harry Pavlidis is here. You guys know Harry. He is the director of technology for Baseball Prospectus. And PitchInfo.com is his company with Dan Brooks from Brooks Baseball. So there's Harry. Hello,
beer
everybody.
Beer in hand. My kind of guy. Am I the only one who's beerless? We need to correct that. All right, so yeah, this is the smart guy panel. And I'd like to start with you guys telling me what's dumb about the industry. Like, because I feel... that's what I'm interested in, because I love the blend of the human scouting side and then the sabermetric stuff, and I don't think more information is bad, knowledge is power, all of that stuff, but I, as a consumer, feel totally overwhelmed by it. So I'm curious what, and anybody can jump in, I'm curious what you guys think is bad about
it. If you're asking the question, you're a step ahead of what's bad.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I think what's bad is that we feel like this information, this data we're getting has been somehow anointed as perfection and really good. And, you know, my entire business is dealing with the imperfections in the data. And so to the data vendors out there, keep screwing up. Really, this is a really hard thing to do, is to track the ball with these technologies, and it's not as clean. So what really is bad about the industry is that we look at this data and we say things like we can have robot umpires and we know everything about the game, and this data is telling us all the answers to all the questions that we have, and that's bullshit.
That's refreshing to hear in and of itself, because there's some stuff that I end up feeling... All right, that's too much. I can't even take that into account. Is there some realm of perceived smart data or smart stats that you, Craig, find to be absurd?
I mean, you know, all of it is difficult on some level. You're asking people to take a step here and then a step here and a step here. And I think the problem is when you're not willing to make that first step and you just say, no, that's bad, and you say, well, look at these war leaderboards, and Kevin Kiermaier's on there, and I don't like Kevin Kiermaier, so I think that he's bad. And, well, I say, well, look at the RBI leaderboards, and Eric Hosmer's ahead of Mike Trout.
Right.
What do you think about that?
All right, let me get specific.
That's a good point.
I get annoyed by the constant flashing of win probability during games. And I am aware of what that metric indicates, but I'm also aware of decades of watching baseball and what it feels like. I know things are difficult to win at certain times. Do you feel like that kind of thing, or coolstandings.com, which I think is now under the aegis of Fangraphs, if I'm not mistaken? I feel like those
You are not mistaken.
Okay. I feel like those are fetishized by some when I don't think they're a be-all, end-all. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of stats out there that are fun but also sort of trivial, as opposed to, like, a lot of the work that, like, Harry and Rob do are sort of you're trying to be very, you know, make some important determinations about, like, what you think might happen. I'm talking.
That's my mom and dad.
Welcome to my
NBA.
World.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, when you're looking at win probability and you say 90% win probability, that's 1 out of 10 times that's the outcome that you think is going to happen is not going to happen. And 1 out of 10 times might not seem like a lot. But when you're talking about hundreds, if not thousands, of baseball games, it's something that happens quite a few times.
I don't want to see win probability during the game. I mean, to me, it doesn't really, as a fan, where I'm like, this is a good game. I'm more interested in watching what's going on in the field, like how the pitchers are approaching things, you know, just like actual baseball. And the fact that there's like a certain probability that can be assigned to what one team is going to do, I think is awesome and great and something I want to deal with separately from actually partaking in the ball game. So even though I could make my living off of all these baseball stats and numbers, I don't want to see my work or do my work during the game. I just want to enjoy the baseball game and what's happening.
So to kind of add to what Harry said, I think there's a lot in win probability that's not actually taken into account, like the order, the next three hitters that are up, things like momentum that we smart guys are not supposed to believe in. They're probably real. We just can't measure them. And I think if you're a good sabermetrician, then you acknowledge the things that you don't know. And when we say that a team is like 90% likely to win a game, what that really means is 90% plus or minus some amount. It could be 10, it could be 30, you know, percentage points. And if you're really savvy, then you acknowledge that it's anywhere in that band of probabilities, and you don't really know what it is in there. It's all those marginal effects from momentum and psychology and who's up next and all those other things. That's what makes the game interesting. I think it's important to acknowledge all that stuff at the same time as you say it's 90% probable.
I find it borderline shocking that you even mentioned momentum. Like, how many people up on the stage believe that momentum exists?
Yeah, there's no doubt that there is a psychological component to performance in sport. Like, are you kidding me? Are we actually debating that?
Well, I mean, I hear many people debate it,
well,
and
we can't measure it really well. Like, we really suck at measuring. Like, I think like 15 years ago, I was on one of like pre-Twitter, some Cubs blog. Maybe some of you guys were on it, but people were like, you can't quantify clubhouse chemistry and atmosphere. I was like, yeah, you can. You just need an operational definition. And the one I proposed was how many like cans of string, that stuff you spray, that like fun stuff.
Silly
yeah.
string.
Yeah, how much you can measure that. And that's how happy your clubhouse is. but it's like you can measure. We just don't, and we don't want to do it. And look, I know people gave like the 60 Minutes thing recently with Theo Epstein a lot of shit about like character, but you sign Chapman and all that. It's like, well, when they talk about that character thing, and people are yelling at them about that, they may not be talking about the character that we all care about
They're
as
not.
Human beings.
They're talking about a baseball character.
Exactly. They're talking about clubhouse presence and where you are and how you impact the clubhouse. And these guys, it's like the old Supreme Court thing about, I don't know pornography, but I can't tell you the definition, but I know it when I see it. And it's the same thing. Like, it's probably where we are with clubhouse chemistry. But teams are measuring it. Teams are looking at that. And there's no doubt that players are preferred or not preferred. And if they... David Ross, for Christ's sake. I mean, come on.
Yeah, but Lester's doing just fine.
Yeah. Oh, shush with that.
Your background, you know, I can't tell you how many times I've read prospect stuff from you and the scouting side of it. How do you balance the marriage between the stats and what the numbers tell you and then the human side of scouting that every scout I tell you or that I talk to, they say pretty much across the board, I have to sit with the guy. I have to talk to him. I have to have that human side of it before I will advocate drafting or signing the player.
That's a very good point. I mean, I'm doing a lot of draft stuff right now and talking to area scouts about guys as we're trying to put a top 200 together, and makeup's a big part of it. And not just is he a good guy, but how hard does he work? You know, how does he handle adversity? Those types of things. You know, it was Theo Epstein back when everybody thought Theo was just a stat guy, back when Moneyball was really in vogue, and he was the young guy of the Red Sox, and everybody thought he was all stats and no scouts, and I think missed the point that I think Theo's greatest strength is being able to assemble very good staffs around him with a wide range of opinions and then synthesize what they come up with and making decisions. But Theo Epstein years ago talked about, it might have been like his first or second year as GM of the Red Sox, that stats matter, but the balance between stats and tools, the stats matter more as you get closer to the big leagues because you're going to have to perform when you get to the big leagues. But when you're an A-ball, the tools matter more than the stats. And when you're at the amateur level, I know people have written and sometimes think you can read into college stats. And teams look at all kinds of college data looking for an edge, who hits what on Friday nights when you're facing the best pitchers and that type of thing. But having done this for years, to me, like high school stats are obviously totally worthless. And college stats are, for the most part, worthless because you can't even look at the team you're playing. It depends on what day of the week you're playing them because of the caliber of pitcher. You're facing a much better pitcher on Friday night than you are on Tuesday. The park factors are crazy. And so to me, I'll look at college stats, and I use them. To me, they only matter for red flags. If there's a guy who's supposed to be a good hitter and he's hitting 310, well, okay, why is he not hitting better? Or if the guy's supposed to have power and he's only got three homers, or although this is a great example of how this is totally wrong, Jeff Samardzija, when he was at Notre Dame, was throwing 95 and averaging about 4.5 strikeouts per 9 innings. And he was there were a lot of diverse opinions. Some guys really liked him, like obviously the athleticism and the arm strength, and if you get him away from football, he might be better. And other people are like, he's just not missing any bats. And he has to have – if you go look at what he did, I think it was his first full year in the minors. He was in the Florida State League. I think he gave up twice as many hits as he had strikeouts. If you looked at his numbers that year, you'd say this guy has no chance. And I remember writing a column on it, Baseball America, where I can't remember who I talked to from a statistical standpoint, and they're like, these are terrible, can't ever see this guy doing anything. And then in that case, scouts were like, look, he needs can't keep guys off his fastball, it's a really good arm, he needs time. And he was an example of where stats meant almost nothing because he was such an athletic player. So it's really a balance.
I think they had the wrong stats, though. It's like if you're looking at college stats, it's like the people who have done good work with them, they contextualize them to the ninth degree. I mean, everything is like, it's Tuesday. You're pitching it. You're facing a guy who's not the Friday starter. There's a real difference in the quality competition.
But even if you look at the Friday starter, you're talking 14 weeks out of the year.
Oh, sure, exactly.
It's such a small sample.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. So you have this. So you can contextualize everything, but you have these huge error bars. Like you have this. That's a big thing. It's like we always say, there's this number, but what is the margin of error? What's the uncertainty around that? So for a guy like Samardzija, he was the fourth starter or something for another.
He was a weekend. I think for pitchers it matters less because you're facing the same lineup, but. But it bothered me looking at him when I had some guys tell me the guy's got a first-round arm, and the other guy, and I'm wondering, the guy's throwing 97, and he's playing in the Big East. How come he can't strike out more than one guy every two innings? And what's crazy is, if you look in the minors, he was terrible. If you looked at his numbers in high class A, you would never have thought he would have been in the big leagues, let alone have a decent career.
Yeah, Samardzija was a weird guy to watch coming up, because looking at his pitch data and even seeing it when he was coming up in the minors, I remember the spring training where his data finally looked good. Like, there was actually this, image of, this is a pitcher who has, these distinct, there's a splitter, there's a cutter, there's a sinker, there's actually four usable pitches here, and I'm like, this is it. I'm picking this guy as having a breakout year, and that was the first good year he had. But the other breakout guy I picked that year was Brian Mattis, who I also use as an example as what can go terribly wrong with a major league pitcher. So Samardzija was one of those guys where I think in my position of looking at the data that the scouts could anticipate coming, I kind of saw the click of this is the arm action they were talking about. He shortened up his delivery. He made some changes. He didn't look like the same pitcher. He changed his attitude about things. So to me, there was this definite what were they doing signing this guy, giving him so much money? But Jim, you got to give credit to Jim Hendry and his scouts. They saw it and they understood the character of the person, and they ignored the stats, they ignored the performance, and knew that he would develop into what's become a solid, regular rotation number.
Now, when you're talking about the data, when you say the data looked good, I love Brooks Baseball and look at stuff there. I remember, was it 2006 when PitchFX hit? Then all of a sudden I'm like, oh, my End God, look at this. Now I can go back and look at a play-by-play and look at sequence. I can see stuff like that. When you say the data looked good, what does that mean for a pitcher, and what does it mean now as opposed to
it depends on the pitcher. Every pitcher is different, but Samardzija, we knew what he was working on and his different pitches that he was trying to develop, and then when you can see that there was kind of in basically scatter plots of how the pitches were moving or how fast they were going or what direction they were spinning, there was a consistency and a regularity to the data that showed that he's making these pitches, he's executing these pitches, and he appears to be repeating his delivery,
mm-hmm.
which was something that he was not ever doing until he shortened up.
And this is tracking ball path.
It's tracking the movement where his release is. And when guys have inconsistent release points, whether their extension is weird or they're changing their arm slot, the movement on the ball gets different, and you get this kind of like messier pattern of pitches.
Mm.
And that was something that Samardzija would occasionally, you know, lurch in and out of when he was in the minor leagues. Not stuff that the public could see, but I was able to see it working on it. And then it was a spring training where I was like, this is it. Like, this is what we've been looking for out of this guy. And if you go watch his games, he looks good, like the on the camera. Like, and the same thing happened with Matt Harvey when he came back from his elbow surgery. That, like, the first flat, people were like, how's Harvey going to be? And I had to sit there, like, biting my tongue because I'd seen, like, his first spring training game in St. Lucie, and the data looked just delicious. It was perfect. It looked exactly like it did before.
Delicious data.
Yeah, and it was like, this is, like, yeah. And it was like, this is sexy. See, this guy's,
you know,
nasty.
This is the stuff. This is not stats. You know, there's, like, this blanket term for that. That's quantifiable scouting, right? I mean, this is, like, what Pitch Effects did and then what Field Effects, and I'm sure, but, like, this is... That's the realm that has always excited me, and people kind of sweep that under some stats umbrella, and that's not what we're talking about.
I mean, I think scouting is really just an effort to quantify all those things that we can't quantify with a radar gun or a pitch FX machine. I think that's always been the case. There's always been this false dichotomy between measuring something and writing down a precise numerical reading versus what a scout does, which is attempt to assign some kind of grade, which is in fact a numerical reading about what they think this guy's going to be relative to average. And so I think it's always been that way, that the teams have access to this great set of information from scouts, from the kind of data that Harry gets to see and we don't get to see, from all these different sources. And what they do is they blend all that together. And that's a very complex endeavor that we don't really get to do in the public sphere because we don't have access to half of it.
How has that realm of quantifiable scouting changed what you do, Jim? Because, people go to you to find anecdotal stories and comps and evidence, but how has this changed your job?
It's changed it some. I mean, not a ton, because I don't have access to a lot of the data. I mean, I wish I did, but it's more... I mean, you talk to scouts, and they talk about spin rates. You know, it's and that stuff, again, it's not widely available. But at events, like they have this big World Wood Bat Showcase in Jupiter every October, and TrackMan, they have, like, as many as, like, 12 diamonds going at once. And TrackMan, I think, has stuff set up on at least one cluster of four diamonds. And they'll track, like, the guy who has a high spin rate, they'll make note of that, or a low spin rate for same reasons. You still, for amateur scouting, a lot of this stuff isn't available. You don't have pitch FX for these college guys. I mean, there is stuff, there's a lot of film work that goes on in the Cape Cod League. I suspect there are teams doing some very advanced things and measuring things and not making it public what they're measuring and sharing. But in terms of what I do, I mean, I hear more bits and pieces of it, but I don't have access to it. I mean, I wish I did. It'd be great. And you can look at stuff. But, I mean, I do the same thing. I look at the TrackMan leaderboards from Jupiter and look at the spinner. Like, for instance, he never wound up being that good of a big leaguer, but he got to the big leagues, which surprised me too. But one of the best college pitchers I've covered, especially in terms of pitching the College World Series, was Michael Roth, who was this guy who threw like 86 miles an hour at South Carolina. And I remember the first time I saw him pitch, it was an elimination game. South Carolina had lost early in the College World Series. So to climb out of the loser's bracket, so you're digging, okay, we have to give a start to somebody. We'll give it to Michael Roth, and I don't remember if it was a shutout, but he pitched a complete game against Clemson and wound up breaking Clemson's heart, and then they went on to win the national championship, and then they won the second year, and then they went back a third year and lost in the finals, and he threw 86 miles an hour. And I remember he was like an eighth-round senior sign for almost nothing. I remember the next year, like April 15th, and somebody tweeted, oh, he's been promoted to the big leagues. I'm like, big leagues, that's not right. Like, what, is he promoted to Double A? No, he was promoted to the big leagues, and actually I think got a win his second day in the big leagues, and he's had a cup of coffee. But anyway, getting back to TrackMan, he was in the fall league that offseason, and he had the highest spin rate on his fastball of anybody in the fall. Like, they didn't measure every game, but all the guys that they got readings on, and I was like, okay.
Hmm.
You know, he had the highest spin rate and won the highest extension. So his 86 didn't look like 86 to the hitters, and that was, you know, obviously we know that there's more than just velocity. It's not just, okay, he's throwing 86. He sucks because he wasn't sucking. But I could never, you know, that was some evidence. Okay, how is he thriving? Not just, you know, doing well, you know, just hanging in there, but thriving at 86. And it's because he's got high spin rate, and so he gets this great riding life. And he's great extension, so he's releasing the ball closer to home plate. So his 86 probably looked like 95 to guys.
So if I'm Joe radio host or Joe fan, and I don't have all of the info and some of it's proprietary and all that, what should I be looking at? I want to know why Kyle Schwarber's struggling. Like, and I know that batting average is elementary, and I understand OPS, and maybe I even understand OPS plus and some of the other stuff. Like, you guys are going to say, you're going to be asked a question, and you're going to try to diagnose the problem. How do you, like, take us through the process of evaluating, like, the run-of-the-mill baseball question that any fan would have?
You know, I think that, you know, when you go through and you see a player who's doing something that you don't expect them to do, whether it's Kyle Schwarber struggling or, like, Ryan Schimpf hitting a million home runs or, you know, whatever it is, like, you run down, like, a battery of stats to say what is abnormal. Like, if a player is running a high batting average, you look at his BABIP. And if it's super high, you're like, well, you know, he's just having a run of good luck. If you're looking at Kyle Schwarber, you might say, well, is he making hard contact? Is his walk rate and strikeout rate about where it should be? And if his walkout rate and strikeout rate are about where it should be, and, you know, they've got, you know, the new StatCast numbers, they've got X WOBA expected, you know. And, I mean, basically what they do is they take the launch angle and the exit velocity, and they say, well, on average, this is what happens. And right now, Kyle Schwarber happens to be one of the unluckier hitters as far as, you know, hitting the ball hard but not getting a decent result. And so there's you want to look at, you know, whether or not they're swinging at pitches outside the zone. And, you know, all of these stats are available on Fangraphs.com. But, you look at all of these stats and say, what's abnormal for him in his career, what's abnormal for an average player to be doing, and if you find something that's a little bit abnormal, that's where you start doing the deeper dive. That's where you go to Brooks Baseball and you say, are these pitches here or are they here, and you figure out exactly where he's swinging, what's happening to the ball once you know it leaves the pitcher's hand, essentially.
I think the most important thing to look at the pitch data is, to segue nicely off what you just said, is location. So, like, looking at pitchers, everybody likes to start with the velocity or the movement, and the systems are really precise and nice with how they measure things, but there's enough noise where we try to make a narrative out of a 2-inch change in a pitch movement. And I wouldn't bother doing that because it might be nothing. It may be small. But more of, like, look at what a pitcher, if his performance has changed, if it's getting better or getting worse, he's having good luck or bad luck, look at what his by pitch type, what the pitch locations are. And if he's throwing the different locations or he seems like he's missing a spot, he's not keeping a certain pitch down, that's usually where the story is. And it usually ends up then tying back to some mechanical issue or, you know, if you listen to catchers, they talk about how they set up and position their targets to help pitchers with certain mechanical
It sounds like issues. We're talking about Jake Arrieta.
No, I mean.
Well, I mean, like, everybody's searching for answers and have been for a while. That's a guy who's missing his spots with his most important pitch. Well,
yeah,
and the velocity.
Yeah, I mean, he's a guy who has a delivery that's really hard to
replicate.
Yeah,
you look at Jake Arrieta and you think, well, you saw his breakout at one point, and you saw what was going on with, you know, he mastered a few different things to make him break out, and you see the breakout, but you don't see the 10 different variations of things that he worked on before he got to that breakout, and every pitcher is constantly doing that, and you're not paying attention to those, and you see some pitchers struggling through that, and then all of a sudden it clicks. And then you see the Jake Arrieta breakout, and then you see when maybe he loses a couple miles an hour on his velocity, or, you know, like, you know, right now Jose Quintana has been throwing his two-seamer a little bit less. Is that something? Is that something he's tinkering with? I mean, it's you just don't know until it plays itself out, but you know it when it works really well.
Yeah, I think that's an important thing, like that pitchers can click. I mean, at Samarja, we talked about, like, this is a thing where mechanics
you
settle.
You and Samarja.
Yeah, I mean, well, I'm just trying to, like, keep the loop tying back through, you know, the previous conversation here. But basically,
you're like a stand-up
pitchers basically do go through that process where they get their shit together, basically. They master their command. And there's a lot of things with a lot of these power pitchers where they master their command to the point where they can change from a four-seam fastball to a two-seam fastball. Because they can control a pitch that has some movement on it. So if you look at Samarja, he throws a lot of two-seam. You won't think of him as a sinker ball thrower, but he throws predominantly two-seam fastballs. So he's a guy who relies on a bit of an angle and a bit of movement. That's, you know, he's asking for a lot of, you know, difficulty with his command. So it's easy for him to fall out of sync, and I think that's what Baltimore got sick of, was that the guy has the stuff, but he never, you know, never figures out. The Cubs are like, this guy will figure it out. The question is, how long can he sustain it? And we're not getting the best answer right now.
You guys keep talking about, you know, like how things play out, and Spiegs mentioned win probability earlier. We got people from 538 Fangraphs up here. You guys have projection models, and I know it's not perfect comp, but, you know, I was trusting 538 come election season. And
there it is. there it is.
And you know, there's also, like,
who had 915?
You know, but regardless, but I understand that, like, 24% comes through sometimes, right? I'm a gambler. But also, like, I
want 28%.
28%. My bad.
Just for context, that was I think it was exactly Chris Bryant's batting average last year. So,
oh
yeah.
Well,
so nobody's surprised when Chris Bryant gets a hit.
Right. Right. No, yeah.
That was some specious stuff right there.
All right, but
yeah, no.
That
did nothing.
That aside.
Was that like an internal memo that, like,
yeah, right.
Straight from the top. Straight from the top.
It's Nate Silver here, and I just want to let everyone know that if you get a question about this,
here's some handy talking points.
It goes beyond that, though, right? Like, I'm watching the NBA playoffs, and it just recently came that you guys had the Cavs as the favorites to make the NBA Finals. And I'm like, I'm watching these damn games, and I know that that's not true. And the Fangraphs baseball, like, the playoff projection models that people trust, right? Like, Cubs fans feel good about themselves because it's like, oh, they still say.
People trust? Gamblers?
Yeah, well, I'm a gambler. I'm a gambler. But it's like they're still favored to make the playoffs. So when – how do – explain them to me. Explain the projection models, how they come about, how much they should be trusted, because I feel like people give you guys, like I'm doing, an unnecessary amount of shit when they're wrong, and I'm curious
I'm
how much
so
stock
happy
I should
they're
be
not
putting
asking
into
me
it.
This question.
Well, so everything is based on looking backwards, so it's all retrospective. So if you see a team that has this many good players and they're this good, then you expect them to do this well in the following season. Similarly, during an election, if you have a candidate that's leading by this much with this many days left, historically, how many times do they win? And that's both a strength. That's the best way we know how to measure the probability of something happening. But it's also a weakness when you have situations like that have never happened before. So that happened this past season in the election, right? There were a lot of norms that were broken and a lot of new things that happened that hadn't happened before. And that's happened, I think, to some extent in baseball the last few years. We've had changes potentially to the ball, or at least to how hitters hit, and all sorts of other things. And it's resulted in a new kind of baseball that we've never seen before. As we look backwards and say, oh, teams that look like this did this well, we're relying on a different environment than what is currently holding. So I think that they do get a lot of shit, and it's not well-deserved. I mean, they're machines. You know, they take the data from past seasons or past years, and they spit out the best guess of what will happen. And sometimes what happened before is not relevant to what's happening now. And we can't really predict very well when that will be the case.
I can't believe you just called Nate Silver a machine.
I don't want to break this to the world, but I feel like I need to. Nate Silver does not hand compute the probability of... the presidential
It's when people in conversation slavishly cling to the machines that things get a little complicated, a little
right,
problematic.
Right, and I think what Nate does well is he's always willing to acknowledge the bounds of the machine, and I think that I mentioned this before, that the best sabermetricians are able to say, this is what the machine says, but these are the shortcomings that the machine has.
With the projections, what I always like gets me is that, like, we're projecting not just performance of all the individuals, but like how the rosters will be constructed, and we have no freaking clue. So we would be a good thing at BP if we can go back and like take Pakoda and say if we knew if we had actual proper depth chart at the beginning of the season, how would we actually get things right? for a change.
This is something that you could all answer through your own prism if you want, but let's start with Jim. The amazing amount of misses in the first round of a baseball draft, historically, over the decades, is attributed to what? Is it humans between moment of draft and moment of potential arrival at the big league level? Is it scouting staff? Some are better than others. Is it a misread of stats? What do you think? Because the hit rate is pretty low.
Well, it's a number of things. And one of these things I always this time of year tell myself I'm going to do, and I never got around to doing it. I don't think the miss rate is that much different than the NBA or NFL. Now, those guys go straight to the big leagues in most cases. And in MLB, it looks worse if your guy flames out in Double A and doesn't get to the big leagues. But does that make the guy worse than Jamarcus Russell? No, Jamarcus Russell was terrible. That's a huge bust, but he played in the NFL, so right. You don't ever have like, oh, Jesus, God never made it. But
he could throw the ball through the goalposts from his knees at the 50-yard line.
Exactly. That comes up a lot in the game.
It does.
So I think I think how bad it looks
is because they never actually get there.
Probably. Right, is the guys who don't make it there at all look bad. But I think it's a number of reasons. One, I think unlike those other sports, you're projecting, it's not, you know, yeah, I mean, especially with the quarterback, and I won't even taunt Bears fans about Mitchell Trubisky. But it's, you know, but for most of the cases with the NFL guys, you're talking about what can they do now? NBA guys, what are they going to do now? You know, it might be a couple cases, a year, 2 years from now, 3 years from now, he'll be, you know, better equipped. But for the most part, these guys are stepping right in. In baseball, even your best college players are usually a couple years away. So you're projecting further on guys. I think injuries with pitchers, I don't think there's a comparable analogy in any other sports where you can have – I still think about, like, back in my early days of Baseball America, nobody probably remembers Roger Salkeld was one of the best pitching prospects in baseball. Looked like he's going to be a superstar, got hurt. I don't think he ever played in the big leagues, got hurt in AAA. I just recently did a story on whether Hunter Green was the best right-handed high school pitcher of all time, and short answer is he's overhyped a little bit. But I had a guy bring up Kiki Jones, who I bet nobody in this room remembers. But Kiki Jones was like a number six or something picked by the Dodgers 1 year. Little guy. He was like basically like Flash Gordon, but with better stuff. And go back and look at his numbers early on in his pro career. He was great in rookie ball. And then they jumped him to high eight, age 19, and he blew out his elbow, and he was never the same guy. But so I think injuries are another thing. And then I think also tying into the projection thing, I think it's almost impossible – to project how a player is going to hit big league pitching. I mean, you kind of hope you know, but like even if you're seeing high school guys on the showcase circuit, which is a lot different than it was 25 years ago, you're seeing the best high school players against the best high school players.
Just the difference between big leagues and everything else is so vast.
So there's that, and then pitchers too. One of the things that's really underrated is your amateur pitchers, for the most part, if it's a high school pitcher, he's pitching once a week, you hope. But once a week for 2 months, 2.5 months, college pitchers pitching – once a week for 4 months. You get to pro ball, you're pitching every fifth day if you're a starter for 5-6 months, and sometimes guys' stuff drops. But there's no rhyme or reason. It happens to some guys, it doesn't to others. So there's just – I think there's such a great gulf between what you're drafting, what the guy's going to be. Mm-hmm. But also, I think if you stacked it up and you graded against guys like Jamarcus Russell or Michael Olcondi, I don't think the bust rate – if you look
candy
at
man.
It – and I think I won't get long-winded on this, but I do think a lot of draft studies get caught up on, you know, hey, the guy made it to the big leagues, so that's a good pick, which isn't necessarily true. Or, you know, whatever study you do that turns up Mike Trout, it's going to look like that demographic's awesome because Mike Trout basically produces three times your reasonable explanation for even a superstar, and it skews the data. Like, I think the drafting 17-year-old high schoolers versus 19-year-old high schoolers, yeah, I'd rather have a 17-year-old, everything's equal, but that gets overblown because Mike Trout was 17 years old. And if he wasn't, then that wouldn't look as one size as it was, and that's just one player. But it's just tough. I don't think the busts are as bad. If you look at the number of successful, say, first-round picks are in baseball, mm-hmm. you know, which I think is roughly about one-third of the picks, I think it's probably the same as true probably in the NBA and NFL.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest changes, I think, for that bust prevention, this kind of goes back to what you were talking about earlier with the showcases, is these showcases have data, and a lot, like NCAA, D1 D1, there's lots of data being collected on the on these pitchers. So this kind of like, why is this guy getting guys out type of question. Their stats may not match things. They can, and you know, they don't have to scout as much. They have a little bit of insight now through data. So I think you're starting, you may actually see more stat inverted drafting out of college players, well, guys
the,
who have
and the
stuff.
And the draft isn't the only place where you can find baseball players. I mean, you know, a third of professional baseball players come from outside of the United States. So you're building a different competition level. And when someone gets drafted, there's 750 players in the majors. There's another 3,000 in the minors, and you got to bypass all of those guys in order to make it.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredibly high odds, but I think with all the – I mean, everything we've kind of talked about tonight about, like, data and personality and what Jim's talking about, like how much the scouts have to sit with a guy to understand him, I think – you know, I think if there's anything to take away about baseball stats is that the stats are really there to augment the human element, whether it's the scouting or, you know, the psychological aspects of it. If the stats don't match what you're seeing and what your people are finding, you're not gonna follow the stats. That's not stat-driven that way.
Let's get some questions from the audience. Anyone have a question for the panel? Thank you, Kevin.
I have a question for Jim, actually. When you're going out to scout someone, whether you've seen the person before or not, do you find that it's advantageous to not have gotten an outside opinion from another evaluator before you go and see the person or before you've actually sat with them to see some of the off-field aspects, or would you prefer to have someone else's opinion before you see them?
It's not going to be a great answer either way. It's like I can't avoid it because what I do, and I've been doing it for 30 years, it's very rare that I don't know something about the guy before I see him. I mean, I do know from talking to scouts, like especially guys who are pro scouts, because amateur scouts, you're going to have a general idea of who you're going to see. But I know talking to pro scouts, like if they're covering a team in particular, not necessarily targeting a specific guy, they like to not, like, I mean, they'll know some of it, but they try not to look into the background of guys. They don't want to know this guy was a first-round pick, this guy was you know, a 10th round pick. They'd rather watch the guys take infield, take in and out, hit BP, maybe throw in the bullpen and try to figure it out. Like, I remember, like, he wound up actually pitching big leagues last year, but Gerardo Concepcion, when the Cubs signed him, made no sense to me, like, why he got it. I think he got $6 million. And I don't do that much international stuff, but at Baseball America, Ben Badler was our international guy, and he's really good at it. I remember reading his report, and I'm like, why did this guy get $6 million? It just doesn't sound like there's not a lot of projection. The stuff's very mediocre. And I remember talking to guys in Midwest League, and none of them could believe it when I bring him up. Like, some of them didn't even know because they, like, didn't really do much on him because he sucked. and they're like, wait a minute, he got $6 million?
Yeah, and he just got released by the Cubs within the last week.
But I will say, he did get to the big leagues, which I never would have thought happened. I mean, it was a cup of coffee.
Think he was the guy, and correct me if I'm wrong out there in the audience, if you guys know people right there. Like, wasn't he told not to throw his changeup at one point in, like, low A? So there's, like, weird things happen like that where maybe they made a decision, like, we don't want you to be relying on this pitch, and maybe, oops, that was all he had. So.
Question down here.
I get the fact that there's a lot of data taken now. For all types of things, you know, arm angle and speed and rotation and spins and all that stuff. But there's a difference between the data that's being taken from teams that's not, not accessible by the media, and the data that's being taken by, let's say, any kind of like prospectus data collecting units. Is there like a kind of like race to kind of get more information so that some information is more valuable than other? Because I mean, you know, like we're talking about all these speeds and whatnot, and there's all the intangibles like momentum, but there's also what happened. You know, they were talking earlier about what wives are putting on Twitter, you know, like what happened earlier in the day, how is that going to affect a pitcher? How does something affect the pitcher on a basis, whether it's a day that they had something impact them or a day that wasn't posted on media? how does that affect a pitcher? You know, like,
all right, there's a lot of
data,
stuff there.
Yeah, when does that data
I think get, what I think what happens is, like, you don't – that's the thing where the saying in the game is that you nobody knows your prospects better than you. So you all those issues, you like, why is this guy not performing? Like, it could be a guy who's having trouble getting visas for his parents to come from the Dominican or something, more like a Cuba in reality. But there are really problems that guys go through that are real problems that are maybe affecting why they're performing. But you don't know that, and that's an important thing, is why, which is why they're scouting, which is why there's human intelligence in this, which is, you know, there's no way to know. You, what you do know is that you don't know, and that's where you have to do your due diligence. And I think that's what kind of what Jim finds out, and when he's talking about scouting. But like, we know that there's all these things happening. If we could possibly quantify and get those things into the bucket, we could. But as important as those things are, we know we'll never be able to exhaust it with it. So we kind of have to shrug and go, yeah, error bars.
So there are some ways that you can get at it. I think Matt Swartz did a study about this, that teams are better at valuing their own players than any other team. So they know about whether some guy is going through a difficult time in his life. And if they trade him for very little, then that probably means that they know something about him that the other team that's trading for him doesn't know.
James Shields.
Maybe James Shields. So a lot of times we're stuck like chasing what the teams know and inferring from how the teams behave. If they trade some guy for a lot or they trade some guy for a little, that says something about what they appraise the value of that player as.
In the minors, you can sort of tell how a team, you know, will value a player. If they keep promoting a player despite them maybe not having the best stat line, you know, it probably means that maybe they've told that player to work on something and the player worked on, you know, that pitch.
Oh, man, that's not what Moneyball said. That's not what Billy Bean said about, and you know, like, you got promoted. That's the thing. Like, you're right. Yeah. Like, they get promoted because you're not seeing it, but there's another thing where guys get promoted because they were the first-round draft pick.
I mean, that's true as well. But, I mean, some guys are getting promoted and some guys are running a high BABIP and, you know, have a really good stat line and aren't getting promoted. But the guys who are getting promoted, there's something there that maybe in good organizations doesn't have necessarily to do with their draft pick level. And it has to do with something that they've seen to move them along in that course.
Are there any organizations that are still really behind in the information revolution? Because I remember, I've told this story before, I was in a suite with somebody in the Cubs front office, pre-Theo, who said, you know, Moneyball's been proven to be a lie and a sham. They didn't win a damn thing. And I was like, wow, is this really happening? And this was a big-time organization that was just not wanting to have data. So, but does that exist anymore?
Not anymore. I think the Phillies were like one of the last teams that, because they won. And that was basically, well, who was the other one? What?
Diamondbacks.
Diamondbacks hired somebody a year ago.
Literally a year ago, the Marlins.
A year ago, the Marlins finally got on board.
See, Diamondbacks I knew with Dave Stewart, and Phillies finally, Ruben Amaro.
The Phillies, it was like they were literally one of the last two teams to hire someone to do analytics, and I think they were the last team to have a full time analyst. Wow.
They made a really, really big deal out of hiring an intern to do analytics.
But to answer your question, no. Like, every team now has a staff, and I think every team has multiple people now. So and smart people that used to be the best people that wrote for Baseball Prospectus or Fangraphs or whatever. Yeah. So it's a different era in terms of understanding what the teams do, because they have all the best people that used to write for the public. And now they're working with better data, and they're doing cooler stuff than we'll ever know about.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's levels to it. Like, there's teams that use it for scouting. Teams then use it, you know, for analytics for the draft is kind of a common first entree where you first go, help us out with some late round draft picks. And I think there's some people we know on Twitter, like Chris Long, who seems to go from team to team, you know, to do that exact work. So you can kind of follow that. But there's also there is still a gap. I think the bottom is raised a lot. Like, there's the floor of, like, we don't know what the hell is going on doesn't exist anymore. Like, I don't talk to too many people saying we're sick of getting beat because of an information gap on trades, for example. I don't think that happens as much anymore beyond the interpersonal stuff we were kind of talking about. But where it's where the gap exists today is on the applied on the field use of it. Changing your pitchers, like pitch selections and approaches based on knowing how their tunnels and their angles work. You know, that is where the applied part of it, and the teams that are really cutting edge are the ones who can recognize a player who they can change into that.
Next question. Microphone in the back.
Yeah, I was wondering how the new training techniques for fastball velocity with the weighted balls have influenced the specific grades that people are getting on their fastballs, because I know that average fastball velocity has increased several miles an hour over the last few years, but it doesn't seem like the specific grades assigned or the range of grades assigned have changed at all.
So like a 70 fastball today is not a 70 fastball 20 years ago? Well,
yeah, it would be
I'm not as fast as I was 20 years ago.
I mean, I know for when we're doing prospect grades, I mean, I'm constantly trying to tell. I mean, it seemed like in the past, 90 miles an hour was considered, oh, you know, that guy's throwing hard. Now 90's probably a 40 fastball. I mean, 92's a 50 fastball. Yeah. We talk about that. And
that's
even fastball grades, I mean, it's like what's the guy sit at, and not just what's the guy sit at. I mean, there are guys who sit at one velocity range in the first two innings and another velocity range in the fifth and sixth inning. So what do you give him? I mean, you have to take all that stuff, I think, with a grain of salt. I mean, I know speaking for us, because we have to put grades on all the prospects, we are trying to be cognizant that, look, I argue guys all the time that, you know, guys throwing 90 miles an hour, even if he's left-handed, it's not a 50 fastball. No. It's just not.
Which is really strange. Yeah. I mean, because there was a time when if a guy threw 90 miles an hour, it was a big deal. And now literally, if you throw 90, you have to be a command profile pitcher. And at a time, that was a power pitcher. I mean, so the game, everybody's changed. So,
and that's
so it makes it really impossible to compare, like, Dwight Gooden's scouting report to, like, you know, someone's scouting report today.
And I was going to say the guns are a lot different, too. You have to bear that in mind, that, you know, Dwight Gooden throwing 95 would be like guys throwing 100 today.
Yeah.
All right, speaking of the guns, we've gone from PitchFX to StatCast this year, right? And everybody's velocity seems to be up a tick or two. Has that leveled off? Are we in a firm new reality, or are things still adjusting themselves as we stand here?
At Twitter.
There's challenges with the data.
Right.
Like, we've actually taken a step backwards in terms of data quality in Major League Baseball.
That seems crazy.
I agree.
Okay.
Yeah, there were some mistakes that were made, and yeah, I think even the people from MLB will say that there were some mistakes.
Say it to you on the record. Is that what you're saying?
No, no, no. Actually, even on the record, an MLB spokesman was willing to say that there were mistakes made in the transition. And I think that's absolutely true. And it's unfortunate that we took a step back. There's no reason that we needed to take a step back, and yet we did. So I think that, you know, it's a big complicated thing, and we can't expect them to always get it right. It's really unfortunate the way that it unfolded. And the thing that I worry about isn't that, you know, there'll be a momentary hiccup in the data where we don't know what fastball velocities mean. The thing I worry about is that 5 years from now, they won't be reporting reliable fastball velocities to us anymore, and we'll be, you know, just kind of clueless.
If you think you guys are annoyed by the changes,
yeah,
talk to some teams. They're pissed. Like, this changed, and the data's that you had, just to get technical, Sport Vision was the company that did the PitchFX system. And it was born of the K-zone. So it was like, get the strikes right, get the strike zone right. The K-zone is broken right now because you have a system which, for a whole bunch of reasons, which some I can tell you and some I can't, you're not getting the most accurate strike zone representation right now. So when you're looking at the K-zone being bad on TV, please don't tweet about it, because it's probably just it being wrong. The data will get better later after they reprocess it. But also, we are in a real situation right now where you had a product that was built by a broadcast television technology company, been replaced by a product that was built by a golf professional club fitting system. So you have a really, really good technology, but it's and if you hadn't had PitchFX before, we'd be like, this is freaking fantastic. But we just lost the product that had the more precise strike zone measurement, folks. So until the TrackMan folks take their radar systems, do some field testing, and retune them, we're going to be at a loss.
Well, so I won't tweet about it, but I will follow up. So how close are we to robot umps? Like, how close are we to this technology?
I told you.
Hey, I don't care if it's cliche.
I knew we would talk about it. We are not close. So the technology went backwards. That I can't stress the importance of that. You had a technology that was honed for the strike zone, been replaced by something that's really honed for the ball coming out of the pitcher's hand. That's a very different thing, and you can imagine, just without being technical, that that's going to change the precision of measurement at the two different places, 60 feet apart. So we've lost something, okay? So do we get it back? I mean, do we do what do we do? I don't know. I mean, it's better than nothing.
I mean, regardless of the technology, the umpires union isn't going away quietly.
Well, but the biggest thing is not the technology. It's the rule book. Right now, if you go, umpires have written about it. It's not just my opinion about the rule book. Like, umpires have said this. Books about umpiring, umpires themselves have written these things that say, look, the strike zone is not defined at the top and bottom beyond these, like, 2 points, like, on the body, but there's no time point in time. So when is the strike zone defined? So right now the rule book is literally not amenable to building an automated strike zone. And your top and your bottom of your strike zone today that they use on the K-zone, even when it was accurate, is by a human. So what you guys are looking at and going, let's use the robot ump thing that they're showing on the screen. That's a freaking human setting the top and bottom, guys. And we have to take that data from that those humans and smush it over time. And
the pitch FX data itself lowered the strike zone once. Yep. Umpires started taking a look at it and started getting graded on it.
They switched the grading system in 2009 from Questec to PitchFX. So now, by the way, umpires are being graded on a system that is noise. So the improvements and the consistencies we've seen over the past several years, which are measurable in umpiring, may stop because they're no longer going to be able to give the umpires really slick, clean grading anymore.
So in 10 years, is an umpire calling balls and strikes, or is it
probably computer? Yeah. I mean, I think what we should have, and we should have very soon, in my opinion, within the next couple years, is some type of support and training and feedback system for the umpires. So you can do that right now within reason, or you know, but
you've got to clean up the tech before you can do that.
You can clean up the tech, which is totally doable. You change, you can fix the rule, you know, and then you can do that pretty easily. And if you modify the rule book a little bit and come up with a good way that you can define a top and bottom of a strike zone, you can then get that part of it, not just the side-to-side stuff. But it's a really weird thing. It's like we always want to replace the humans with technology, but it's like really to what benefit is that? Is it going to make baseball better? Like, are
I just
we
don't
fans,
like Joe West.
Exactly. Can we just replace him?
But I don't know. Like, I don't even know if the players want this to change. It's a weird thing. It's like, yeah, I agree. Like, in theory, it's like we want the strike zone called precisely, right? But baseball.
But what if they just had like a beep every time it was a strike in their ear, and then
that's
the umpires still got to make the decision?
Oh yeah, I want like a thing in the pocket. Basically, it buzzes if the ball caught some of the plate. That let them know. But maybe due to beat after, like, they've done their call. And umpires and their timing and all the stuff and how they make their calls is so important. And it's a human, like, vigilance task to be paying attention to.
No coincidence, I read the story today that DraftServe, the automated beer service at ballparks, has failed miserably and is going away.
We can't even pour a beer.
Remember, they thought that was going to replace bartenders and replace vendors, but no.
I mean, think about all the experiences, you know, like at the airport or at the market, like, you know, the self-help checkout. All these technologies are not infallible. And technologies are engineered by people.
When was the last time you watched Terminator 2?
That's a good point.
Yeah, but basically this is like it's a normal frustration in baseball. But there's this kind of the siren song of technology solving our strike zone problem, but we're not there in terms of what the rules of the game are or the technology. So, Joe West.
I come from a different place than Harry on this. I think that in 3 to 5 years, they could have a working robot umpire. They'd have to invest millions and millions of dollars, and they'd have to hire some very competent people. But I think that they could have robot umpires that did every bit as well as the current human umpires.
No, it's not it's not an intractable problem, I agree, but it's a huge investment.
And I think they should already be putting that money in because, as other people have alluded to, in 10 years, this is going to be, like, unacceptable. Like, the technology will already be there. So they need to be putting this money in.
What about
now.
Changes in society, man? Like, where people are getting, like, it's a real drag if they're losing their jobs to computers. They're going to want to see that in baseball?
I mean, think of all the programmers that would get hired.
All right, we have time for two more questions. I think they're on this side. Who's got the mic?
Right here.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sir.
I was just wondering what you see at the major league level as the possible next market inefficiency that's either attacked by major league front offices or from the outside, like Baseball Prospectus or Fangraphs, and trickles into the front offices?
Market inefficiency, which used to be as simple as, hey, OBP matters, and now has evolved into what? I mean, international dollars have evened out almost across the board. So what's left?
So I think that development internationally is going to be a big deal going forward. I mean, like the soccer teams, which are in some ways ahead of us, right? They employ these academies where they develop players from the time that they're like 6 years old. So I would not be surprised if we saw something similar like that in
baseball.
Don't
we already, don't some clubs have
Dominican academies? Well, they have academies, but you wouldn't be able to sign the players. I mean, you could develop the players, but you wouldn't get to keep them.
I think that they'll have to, like, figure that out. I don't necessarily know if it's workable, but I think that if they could work on a way to make those players loyal or something, you know, I think that there's
well, it's not loyal. It's the rules. You want to be able to pay them.
Like, but if you could have like an RBI program where you got to say, hey, I will sign this player for $3 million who comes up through my RBI program,
right,
that's something that would work out for both sides.
Basically,
yeah,
about assigning players
rights
when they're,
such,
you know, 13.
I mean, it's supposed to be an equal opportunity system. I don't think the teams would ever go for that, because the teams that don't work hard internationally would complain that, like, look, even though you're working harder, it's all supposed to be equal. That's not fair to us.
All right, drafting over slot is gone, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, you have the bonus pools, and you can play with them a little bit. But, yeah, and they've tightened the slots so that there isn't a huge disparity. It's been kind of a shame on the amateur standpoint where it no longer rewards hard work. Or, like, especially internationally, there are some teams that are light years ahead of other teams, and now everybody, you get $4.75 million, $5 million, or $5.25 million. And – you know, like, and locally in the draft, I mean, I use the White Sox as an example of the new system with the amateur draft. Reinsdorf hates the draft. He hates paying guys money. No, I mean, seriously. The reason they got Chris Sale is Reinsdorf almost was like the Boris version of owners. And I know Reinsdorf would hate hearing that. But whereas when Scott has a player, an amateur player, and he tells you he's not going to sign, he's going to go to college, you believe Scott. You don't necessarily believe any other agent who tells you that. I mean, there might be an exception here and there. But, like, Scott sent numerous guys to college. He doesn't care. And Reinsdorf will walk away from players. And that's why when Chris Sale was in the draft and teams outsmarted themselves on Sale and they didn't like the idea that he wanted a big league contract, which at the time all the top college pitchers were getting, and nobody wanted to give it to him. No, it's a low arm angle. We're not sure it's going to work. The White Sox took him, and their position was, look, Reinsdorf's not going to have any give. You're going to have to sign for what this ridiculous slot is, which was, at that point was just an MLB-regulated slot, and he took it, you know, because he had no option. But under the new system, the White Sox spend to their pool every year because that's their allotment. But in the old system, when you could spend whatever you wanted, the White Sox spent less than anybody in baseball. So it's like getting back to the international or the draft, the teams that are willing to spend more, like, I think it's going to hurt the small revenue teams. Like, the Royals built a World Series championship club in large part because they were willing to spend heavily on the draft. The Nationals went from a crappy team by spending heavily on the draft. The Pirates were a very small revenue club that invested heavily in the draft, and now you can't do that anymore. Like, I think it's one of the reasons the Rays have struggled is the Rays also have drafted like shit for about 10 years.
That'll come back to bite you.
That's getting applause.
Under the new system, though, when they were still winning at the beginning of this bonus pool system, they were only allowed to spend $4 million or so, $5 million on the draft. And so if you're a small revenue team that's successful, you can't spend on the draft.
Well, let's follow up on that for a second, because the Rays stayed young and cheap for a lot of years because they had to, and it seemed to work in their favor in terms of pitchers blowing up. They didn't keep any pitcher to the point that he might actually blow up. Is there something there in payroll management or roster management that's kind of getting discovered?
Injury prevention. I think that, you know, you're talking about, you know, market inefficiencies. I know it's something that teams are working a ton on, and it remains to be seen how much progress they're making, but it's health.
Yeah.
They're working on biometrics. They're trying to figure out how to preserve arms. And this is something that teams have been doing, you know, forever, but as the salaries for, you know, crappy pitchers has gone up, teams are trying to make sure that they can keep, you know, even their mediocre guys as healthy as possible. And if a team is successful in doing that, and, you know, for the most part, the White Sox have been fairly successful in keeping their pitchers healthy. If that's something that they can do, that's an efficiency that could be exploited.
I don't know if it's an efficiency, but a change perhaps. I think we've seen like the era of the power pitcher, and I think these guys who throw harder get maybe they're going to start realizing that getting these guys to juice up to their full velocity at age 21 is a bad idea. So you may start to see some temperance in the attitude about how you develop pitchers, because you know, one of the things I've heard over the years from scouts is like, because I used to look at Tim Lincecum and go, why would you, you know, make that guy a starter with that crazy delivery? He won't last. Like, who cares? Let him start for 3 years and blow up. I mean, kind of, he basically went, the path that Tim Lincecum took was actually kind of a planned career path, I'd have to say, based on what the expertise in baseball. They're like, screw it. He's going to be so good, and then he's going to suck. But when he's good, it's going to be so awesome. And I kind of started to look, okay, that's how you develop pitchers. Like, they're going to get hurt. Go ahead and get them out there. But now we're at this point where is it finding these ways to maximize their velocity? Are we actually going past the physical limitations? And do we have to go back to a durability? Like, we got this thing where, like, go 5 innings as hard as you can, and then the bullpen will help you out.
Until we get more teams, it doesn't matter. I mean, we've been without expansion for 2 decades now, I think that, you know, when you don't add more players to the rosters, then you're going to have a bunch more pitchers who come up, who can come in the 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th innings, and you don't need pitchers to go more than 5 innings because you're going to find good ones who can come in the 6th and 7th. If you add a few more teams, you know, 2, 4, however many it is, you're going to be adding to more starting pitchers who, you know, can't go as deep into games. You're going to be taking the bullpens, making them not quite as good. And you're going to need those starters, once again, who can go 6 and 7 innings, because you're not going to want to trust the guys in the 6 and 7 innings.
The innings eater is not a pejorative. It's typically used that way, but I think baseball, like, we're trying to say, why don't we just piggyback all our starters and, you know, everybody throws 4 innings. But I think at some point you're going to see some coming back of, like, I want a guy who will throw 200 innings. I know he's going to throw those 200 innings, and I want him here for 6 years, not 2 years, because of this constant churn in resources is killing me.
So I think the question of the next market inefficiency is a really interesting one, but if any of us knew, then we'd probably be working for teams and making a lot more money, right? So whatever ideas that we have or anybody has about the next market inefficiency, probably 50 to 70% of the smart baseball watchers will hear those ideas and say, this is a dumb idea. There's a big roadblock. And the next market inefficiency is going to be one of those supposedly dumb ideas that someone figures out the way through the roadblock and then turns it into the next market inefficiency. But we don't really know.
It's got to be injury prevention for pitchers, because nobody's sharing that information.
They
right?
keep trying, though.
But I mean, like, one team will have one thing, and people don't share that stuff. So the science collectively is not going to move forward together.
But pitchers just aren't meant to do what they do.
Exactly.
Like, you know, we talk about, you know, a pitcher who's going through struggles and we say he's going to be fine. He's not going to be fine. He's going to get hurt. At some point in time, he's going to get hurt. That's just, you know,
that's philosophy,
the way it
Craig.
Is.
Yeah.
Craig is a beaten man. He's just telling you it's all going to be bad and your favorite pitcher's going to suck.
Stop believing in things.
I think you see it in all sports, though. Like, sleep science is a huge thing. And I know the Cubs believe in it a lot, and you're not going to see the Cal Ripken Iron Man streak anymore because they're not interested in it. And just, we want the guy to be healthy come playoff time and be peaking at the right time. And
this started with the NBA, I think.
Right, exactly.
Yes. With the Spurs, remember there was like media reports like, you're resting your stars. And I think they were measuring.
The other thing that NBA players did, and it was just kind of a collective that made its way throughout the league, the naps. The naps between shoot around and the games just became like a word of mouth thing that they all started doing.
Yeah. It's absolutely a huge part of the NBA, and I think it's coming into, I mean, it should be a huge part of baseball.
I want to have siesta for a month.
Basketball siesta. What time for one more?
Last question here.
So this is a 3-parter, so stay with me.
Oh.
Please eliminate 2.
The last one's about music, Danny. So, Rob, you, a couple years ago, you did a piece where you assigned a run value based on exit velocity and launch angle. Does that correlate with what ex-Woba is saying? And then, Harry, there are times when baseball savants' pitch types don't match up with Brooks. In the future, will that ever be one-to-one? And then, I guess the entire panel... How much of a disservice do you think Major League Baseball is doing in the long run by keeping so much of its data proprietary and not releasing it to the public?
Can I jump?
Hold on. Let me first answer your first question. Yes, the work that I did correlates real well with what Tom Tango did now. So, that all works out.
And no, Savant will never match what we do. We manually curate our data, and they're doing real-time automated pitch tagging, and it won't match.
Yeah, and I can independently verify what Harry says. Harry sells his data, so he has a vested interest in lying to you, but he's not lying to you.
Pitchinfo.com.
His data is better.
So, I mean, no, but
speaking of vested interest, I mean, one thing we have to keep in mind is that MLBAM, the people who provide us with the data, they do not service us. We are not their clients. The Major League Baseball teams are their clients, and
wrong.
You know,
the Major League Baseball teams are not their clients.
Well,
they really aren't.
I mean, they're fight. That's who they give the data to. But,
okay. These are systems made for entertainment broadcast augmentation. The fact that the teams can gather the data and make value out of it is probably a negative.
If I had substituted teams with owners, would that have been?
I mean, no, seriously, it's like this is not for the teams. The data that MLBAM produces and provides directly to the teams, there's a reason why the majority of Major League Baseball teams have contracted me to help them, because the data is not a decision system ready quality for some of the reasons you've mentioned about the tags don't match and things like that. So, no, they are not. This is not for the teams. This is for the entertainment.
The fact that it's are owned teams, by the owners who make money from MLBAM.
Sure, but it's like the idea that it's basically, this is great stuff for you guys to use for your systems is like an afterthought, and my business wouldn't exist if BAM didn't treat it as an after. If they got this shit right, I wouldn't be sitting here.
Well, what is proprietary these days
and the Major League information is a small fraction of what we deal with. Like there are many more installations in minor league, NCAA data. It's a constant flow of data. Major League Baseball, we get like 4,000 or 5,000 pitches a night from Major League Baseball. We probably take in about 30,000 pitches a day from Japan, NCAA, AA and minor leagues, and all these high school wood bat things. Like there's hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pitches on high school guys under age 15. So the data that you guys see at MLBAM is like the smallest piece of what Major League Baseball teams get. And it's not always of the best quality, and it requires a lot of love and care. And if people don't hire me, they actually have staffs in-house that do what we do.
The point I'm trying to make is the thing that the teams get is the 3% interest in MLBAM.
They pay for it. The teams are required to give money to Major League Baseball every year to pay for these pitch tracking systems that we enjoy as public consumers.
And the owners own a $6 billion entity.
And they don't want to spend any money on it. It's really weird. It's like they don't want this stuff. They don't want it. There are teams that don't want this data public. And I think this was one of the things you asked. Is it bad that this stuff isn't public? Absolutely. I think it's one of the biggest mistakes Major League Baseball is making is not just flat out releasing this data to the public. It's wrong. It's not going to benefit our understanding of baseball. It's not going to benefit the entertainment industry, like the broadcast of baseball, and it's not going to help teams make better use of it. The reason why we had success with PitchFX is they let idiots like me go after it and make stuff happen with it. The fact that they're not doing that with StatCast today is, I think, a mistake that you go back, talking about 10 years from now, you look back at 10 years and they will rue this decision. It's caused data quality issues. It's going to stop the ability to bring new resources into the industry. It's a step backwards.
Yeah, I mean, I really can't overstate, like, it's a terrible decision to make this proprietary. It's a terrible decision to let the individual teams decide what's proprietary. And it's really going to blow up in their face. I mean, it's already blowing up in their face. I have teams ask me for recommendations, like who should we hire, and I give them names. And Harry knows too, and I give them names, and they're like, "This guy hasn't worked with the latest data," and I'm like, "No shit, you don't provide the latest data." This is happening constantly. So it's against pretty much everyone involved in baseball. It's against all of their interests, the teams. The entertainment, as Harry is saying, the fans, it's all bad. Yeah, it's really surprising to see them make this catastrophic mistake. I hope that they'll change their mind at some point in the future.
Wow.
But in the meantime, we're all suffering.
Yeah, it's true.
Solid last question, creating some conflict. I like it.
Yeah. On a positive note, we're all miserable and we hate our jobs. Harry, but thanks for coming.
Harry and Craig will be continuing their debate in the bar. Progressively.
All right, round of applause for the last panel. Thank you guys for coming out.
Thanks for sharing some of your proprietary information for what you do.
Yeah, you guys will have to sign a non-disclosure agreement as you leave.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks to Kevin Kennedy and everybody at Pitch Talks. A pleasure to do this every year.
Yeah, thanks for having us back. It was great. All right, we'll be in the bar.